Good morning. This is the Northwestern University Law Review online podcast series. Before joining the faculty of BYU Law, Professor Nielsen was a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Kirkland & Ellis. He's also served as a law clerk to Justice Samuel Alito of the U.S. Supreme Court, Judge Janice Rogers Brown of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and Judge Jerry E. Smith of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Professor Nielsen, welcome.
Nice to chat with you.
So today, we're discussing some essential and controversial aspects of admin law. But before we do that, Professor, admin law is one of those classes that law students feel like they have to take, but aren't sure why, or maybe they don't even take it at all. So why should lawyers and law students of all stripes take admin law?
I'm going to answer that question by cheating a little bit and plagiarizing Justice Kagan. Now, back when Justice Kagan was just Professor Kagan, she wrote one of the most important administrative law articles in recent decades called Presidential Administration. And in her article, she explained that in modern government, administrative law is where the action is, whether the subject is healthcare, welfare reform, tobacco, or guns. And that's a quote. Kagan knows of what she speaks. Before being a justice, solicitor general, dean, or Harvard Law School professor, she was a domestic policy advisor for President Clinton. So she was there for a lot of the big fights in the 1990s. The reality is that administrative law is everywhere. Pick any issue that you care about. There is a very good chance that you will find an administrative law aspect. For instance, assume that your interest is healthcare. Well, King v. Burwell is an administrative law case. Or what about tax? Guess what? The IRS is an agency. There are all sorts of interesting questions about how principles of administrative law influence tax policy. Now, what about corporate law? Well, if you do any big corporate litigation, you're going to care about what the D.C. Circuit has to say. Lots of big corporate law cases, especially involving the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, goes through the D.C. Circuit, and the D.C. Circuit is the nation's administrative law court. Even criminal law has elements of administrative law. Just a few days ago, I taught my admin law students the case of Mistretta, the United States. Now, that's one of the foundational non-delegation cases that we teach. But what was that case about? Mistretta is about the U.S. Sentencing Commission. And of course, there can be criminal consequences for violating regulations promulgated by agencies. So let me end with this. If what I have said so far isn't enough to sell you on why you need to take administrative law, here's this. On the Supreme Court today, you have three justices who came from the D.C. Circuit, the home of admin law: Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Thomas, and Justice Ginsburg. The late Justice Scalia did too. Justice Breyer did not come from the D.C. Circuit. He came from the First Circuit, but he was an administrative law professor. And Justice Kagan, who was also an administrative law professor, was nominated to the D.C. Circuit but not confirmed. All of this is not by accident. In the modern government, the D.C. Circuit is extraordinarily important. And why is it so important? Because administrative law matters. So you should definitely take administrative law. It's one of the foundational classes for a reason.
So given the importance of the subject matter, I'm curious to turn to your scholarship. And recently you've been working on a paper dealing with what you term the unintended consequences of overturning Seminole Rock. That's a Seminole admin law case. Before you do talk about the unintended consequences, can you first tell us what the intended consequences of overruling that decision might be? And then why do we worry, or why ought we to worry about the unintended ones?
Sure. So this is an article that I've been working on. I'm really excited about, forthcoming in the Georgetown Law Journal, which I call Beyond Seminole Rock. So let's back up and say what Seminole Rock deference is, and then we'll talk about why some people want to overrule it, and then why overruling it might have unintended consequences. So hopefully most people listening to this podcast at least have a general sense of what Chevron deference is. Under Chevron, when an agency administers a statute, it generally will receive deference from a court as to the meaning of ambiguous language in that statute. If the language is clear, the agency has to follow it. But if there is ambiguity, generally, the court will step aside and let the agency determine what the ambiguity means, so long as the agency's interpretation is reasonable. Seminole Rock, also sometimes called Auer deference, is similar to Chevron. Seminole Rock deference comes from a case called Bowles v. Seminole Rock from 1945. Auer is the modern restatement of Seminole Rock. It comes from Auer v. Robbins in 1997. In these cases, the agency is not interpreting a statute, but instead is interpreting one of its own regulations. In other words, with Chevron, Congress has created the legal instrument, while with Seminole Rock, the agency has created the legal instrument. The idea behind Seminole Rock deference is that no one knows better than the agency that wrote it what its own regulations mean. Plus, all of the pragmatic justifications used for Chevron apply in the context of Seminole Rock. But like Chevron, Seminole Rock is controversial. As to Chevron deference, for instance, Justice Thomas has questioned whether it's even constitutional on the idea that it's for courts to say what the law is, and under Chevron, agencies say what the law is. And others have challenged various aspects of Chevron. All of those challenges against Chevron, I would suggest, are even more fierce in the context of Seminole Rock. If anything, Seminole Rock is more controversial than Chevron. Indeed, Justice Thomas and the late Justice Scalia have both openly called for Seminole Rock to be overruled, and Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito have suggested a willingness to consider the question. So why is it controversial, and why is it more controversial than Chevron? The fear is that Seminole Rock uniquely creates bad incentives. This is how the Supreme Court put it in a case called Christopher v. Smith Kline. Fairly recently, it was in 2012. Quote, deferring to an agency's interpretation of its own ambiguous regulations undoubtedly has important advantages. But this practice also creates a risk that agencies will promulgate vague and open-ended regulations that they can later interpret as they see fit, thereby frustrating the notice and predictability purposes of rulemaking, end quote. And Professor John Manning at Harvard has famously explained that Seminole Rock deference violates the, quote, same hands principle. The idea is that the same hands that create the law should not declare what it means. Going all the way back to Blackstone and the Montesquieu and the like, the idea is that mixing the law creation and the law interpretation powers has been viewed as a threat to freedom, because the worry is that those who create the legal instrument will write it broadly and vaguely because they know that they can interpret it how they wish in a specific context with retroactive effect. So Justice Scalia and Thomas have adopted that Manning line of argument, and they have vehemently attacked Seminole Rock deference. And you know, to be fair, there is something normatively attractive about their position. It does not seem fair that an agency can promulgate a vague regulation and then turn around and punish someone for violating that vague regulation with retroactive effect. That dynamic may create bad incentives for agencies to write unclear rules because that increases the scope of their discretion. At least that is the normative position put forward by Thomas and Scalia. Look, there's lots and lots of scholarship that goes back way, both ways on that question. So for instance, Cass Sunstein and Adrian Vermeule, they strongly defend Auer/Seminole Rock deference as necessary and legally sound, and they question that story that I just told, that agencies are intentionally promulgating vague rules so that they can later interpret them with retroactive effect. Cass Sunstein, who's got many years of government service, or at least some years of government service at a very high level, we'll say it that way, when he was in charge of OIRA, he says, you know, in my years of experience, I've not seen that. And there's a lot of other scholarship that kind of challenges that story of why agencies might have an incentive to promulgate vague regulations and then interpret them after the fact. Look, that scholarship is what it is. You have strong proponents on both sides, and a lot of people are thinking about it that way. So that's the reason the Supreme Court might overrule Seminole Rock, is because they worry about that. And the pushback is, hey, there's not so much to worry about. My article is different. My article takes a completely different approach. I worry that overruling Seminole Rock may have unintended consequences that actually harm the very regulated parties that the court seeks to protect. Thus, under my article, even assuming for the sake of argument that Justice Thomas is right, it still may be a bad idea to overrule Seminole Rock. And it's counterintuitive, but that's my gist. And here's why. There is another case from the 1940s that has to be considered along with Seminole Rock, and that case is called Chenery II. Now, we're going to get pretty deep into the weeds of administrative law, but it's important. Now, Chenery II is the second Chenery case. There are two Chenery cases from the 1940s. Chenery I is from 1943. Chenery II was from 1947. Chenery, and they stand for very different propositions. Under Chenery II, an agency tasked with administering a statute generally has discretion whether to promulgate a prospective regulation or instead to simply retroactively enforce the statute itself. So an example, in Chenery II itself, the question was whether the SEC should allow a company's reorganization. The owners of the old company structured the proposed reorganization in such a way that they would retain a lot of power over the new company. Those owners did not violate any common law principles. They weren't breaking the law as it existed. Even so, everyone recognized that the SEC, with broad power to ensure that reorganization is in the public interest, could have promulgated regulations prospectively to prohibit what the owners of the company tried to do. Instead of promulgating prospective regulations, however, the SEC decided to enforce the statute directly, retroactively, to thwart the company's reorganization plans. The Supreme Court held in Chenery II that that was okay. Agencies can make policy either through prospective regulation or through retroactive adjudication. Now, there's some exceptions to that, but as a general rule, that's how the law works. Now, Justice Jackson in Chenery II wrote a fiery dissent in which he accused the court of undermining the very rule of law itself and violating principles of retroactivity. But despite that dissent, Chenery II was stuck. It is now firmly the law that agencies can generally act this way. They can either promulgate a rule or not promulgate a rule and then later bring an enforcement action under the statute directly. And that leads to my concern about overruling Seminole Rock. Without Seminole Rock, agencies will have to make a choice. Either promulgate clearer regulations or not promulgate regulations at all, but instead simply enforce the underlying statutes directly via Chenery II. The intended consequence of overruling Seminole Rock is to increase the legal certainty for regulated parties. But the unintended consequence might be the agencies simply say less through regulation and more through retroactive adjudication. Now, from the perspective of a regulated party, that latter option may be even worse than the status quo. After all, almost by definition, a regulation provides more certainty than a statute. If a regulation covers more ground than the statute it implements, it's ultra vires, and so it's unlawful. And agencies already do not receive deference when interpreting a regulation that simply parrots the language of the statute itself. So that's why I say almost by definition, even an ambiguous regulation provides more clarity than the statute it implements. It has to be smaller in scope. Thus, overruling Seminole Rock may lead to less legal clarity for regulated parties, not more, because instead of getting even that limited insight into how the agency understands the statute, the agency just waits, and then once you've done something, brings an enforcement action. The empirical uncertainty about which result is likely to predominate, either the intended consequence of clearer legal rules or the unintended consequence of more adjudication, because we don't know the answer to that empirical question, that counsels in favor of stare decisis. The last thing the Supreme Court wants to do is to make things worse instead of better. If the court is still inclined to overrule Seminole Rock, however, then my paper argues it should also rethink aspects of Chenery II to prevent some of those unintended consequences. For instance, the court could do things to make rulemaking more attractive. For instance, they could change the deference regime for adjudications and go to Skidmore instead of Chevron or something like that. The court could also increase retroactivity, thus making rulemaking more attractive. My point is, if the court is going to go after Seminole Rock, it needs to be thinking about Chenery II at the same time, or it could very well end up creating a situation from the perspective of regulated parties that is even worse than what we have today. So that's kind of the heart of the article, which is different from what other people have said, because I'm accepting the critiques of Seminole Rock on its own terms and still wonder whether the right outcome is overruling or whether we need to step back and look at the whole picture and really understand what's happening.
So moving away from the heart of your article toward one of the issues you discussed there, which is the importance or the role of stare decisis in this area of the law, I'd like to turn to Justice Thomas, who has expressed the position in more than one occasion that the entire modern administrative state might lack a textual hook and may therefore be unconstitutional. He seems to take the position that the scheme too readily takes power out of the hands of elected representatives. And it seems like your argument at least speaks to that. So how do you respond there?
That's a great question. And let me just start by saying, I think Justice Thomas is very smart, especially when it comes to administrative law. Now, last year, Justice Thomas came to BYU and he met with the whole law school and he asked to teach a class, and the class he wanted to teach was administrative law. And the students really loved what he had to say because he's engaging and he's knowledgeable. Again, what is the background of Justice Thomas? You know, he's been on the court for 25 years, so it's hard to remember the pre-Supreme Court version of Justice Thomas, but his background is administrative law. He was in charge of an agency during the 1980s, the EEOC, and then he was on the D.C. Circuit for a short period of time. He was on the D.C. Circuit. So his background is really in administrative law. This is something he knows a lot about. So when he talks about administrative law, I think people should pay attention. That said, as you noted, Justice Thomas doesn't really give a lot of weight to stare decisis, especially in constitutional issues. And for him, a lot of this is constitutional. So unlike many of the other justices, he's willing to wipe away lots of precedent. In that sense, those who are adherents to stare decisis, his arguments can be provocative. They have a headwind. It's hard to justify overruling cases. Even apart from stare decisis, however, his arguments can be tricky. Now, consider non-delegation. I think it's fair to say that the person on the court who most strongly resisted robust enforcement of non-delegation doctrine was Justice Scalia. One of the big non-delegation cases is Whitman, which reiterates lots and lots of the idea that non-delegation review is very limited. And that opinion was written by Justice Scalia. Now, why is Justice Scalia, why was he so resistant to a robust enforcement of the non-delegation? Because he did not think it could be done in a judicially manageable way. On his view, it is just too hard to separate out acceptable delegations from unacceptable delegations, because the question is one of degree and not of kind. He says, you know, Justice Scalia likes rules, and he can say, look, I can understand if I could draw a line, but for me, you're saying a little bit of delegation is okay, but too much is not. Look, courts just can't do that. We're just not built to draw those kind of lines. Now, Justice Thomas has tried to come up with questions of kind in the non-delegation space. Again, I'm looking now at his separate writings in the Amtrak case from a couple of years ago, where he says that, you know, delegation isn't okay for coercive actions that affect private rights, but he hints that maybe it's more okay for public rights. So if the government wants to have, you know, delegation to the president to say who could enter public lands, maybe he's more okay with that. He also says that maybe there's a difference between delegation or where the president or the executive branch itself makes policy rather than just finds facts. Now, the pushback to this, to these sorts of arguments, is they're also tricky line drawing problems. It's hard to know the difference between a public and a private right. It's hard to know when it's fact finding and policy making. It gets complicated. And Justice Thomas acknowledges that in his Amtrak, and he says, but just because it's tricky or hard, that's not a good enough reason not to try. But, you know, for Scalia, he presumably thought differently. Again, where all it plays out, people have different views, but it shows why it's tricky in this area. These are hard questions.
So as we wrap up here, we don't have a ton of time left, but I want to talk a little bit more about a point you made earlier, which is that Justice Kagan paper on presidential administration. And as a point of closing, it seems important to note that she emphasized the role, outsized role, of executive agencies and the executive when it comes to regulating just about every aspect of our society. Recently, I was cued on to research that looked at the Obama administration's major regulations over the last 8 years, and they concluded that think somewhere around 600 major regulations passed during his term. So I want to ask you as we head out the door, and I'm sorry this is such a big question so late, but do you think our current administrative law framework adequately addresses the concerns and the needs of the era of presidential administration?
That is a big question. It's hard to answer a question like that because admin law is so ubiquitous and multifaceted. I think I'd like to end with a thought that I had. Instead of focusing on high-level constitutional things and things of that sort, maybe there's a more practical solution, at least to some of the concerns that people have. And that is this. We could go back to formal rulemaking. Now, again, formal rulemaking, to really understand it, you're pretty deep in the weeds of administrative law. So let me explain. Imagine that there is a regulation that, costs $1 billion or something. I mean, pick whatever number you want, a big number. Under formal rulemaking, an agency, in order to promulgate that kind of regulation, has to defend its decision on the merits through something that's like a trial. They present evidence, there's cross-examination, things of that sort. And that's not really how we do regulations anymore. But it used to be. It used to be a much bigger part of the administrative process. I'm not going to bore you with why it's not. Suffice it to say that we've kind of moved away to informal rulemaking, or notice and comment rulemaking, which I think most of the time, almost always, notice and comment rulemaking makes sense. But there might be a space for experimentation where we want to think about going back in time a little bit to formal rulemaking and seeing if that maybe helps add a little bit more public confidence in the regulatory process by a little bit eliminating kind of the black box, that's the scare quotes, that people say when they talk about regulation. Now, and that's just one example that comes to mind of, we've tried different things before. Maybe there's space for some experimentation. Another idea, and there's all sorts of legislation floating around anymore, all sorts of different ideas floating around in OIRA, in the White House, all sorts of ideas. But another possibility would be a regulatory budget or something like that, which, again, there's pros and cons on all of these. But it seems to me that if we did a little bit of targeted experimentation, maybe we could stumble upon something that really works. It often is an idea to see if we can do better, and the best way to do that is through experimentation. So all sorts of my ideas, they're ideas. But the best way to see if something works is to, think them through, talk it through, have that conversation, and then, if at all possible, do targeted experimentation. Don't just change everything at once, but just see kind of a piecemeal process and see if we can find solutions that through trial and error that work. That's kind of my approach to things is, instead of sweeping everything in one fell swoop, maybe it's better to see if we can careful look at the data and see if there's a way that we can kind of experiment.
Well, Professor Nielsen, with that, we're out of time, and I want to thank you for our conversation here today.
Oh, this is wonderful. I appreciate it. Thank you much.
This has been an edition of the Northwestern University Law Review Online's podcast series. Today, we were talking with Aaron Nielsen. We were talking today about admin law. For this and more content from the Northwestern University Law Review Online, head to our website, northwesternlawreview.org/online. Thank you.